Yeah, I'll start out when I this well okay yeah here we go. This is the seventh sermon on Leviticus 19, which is more than twice as many sermons as I've preached on any chapter of Leviticus up to now. But it's been rich with so many different applications in so many areas of life that I thought it was has been worth slowing down and looking at all the details and considering their applications to our lives. We've looked at the loving your neighbor by creating margin, loving your neighbor by not exploiting their weaknesses, loving your neighbor by protecting their property. That was in the first sermon, I think. Then loving your neighbor by keeping fairness and impartiality and justice, loving your neighbor by protecting their life and their reputation. Loving your neighbor by keeping your heart open to him, not carrying grudges and bitterness. Keeping divinely created boundaries. And then we had another sermon on mirroring God's character of being a redeemer, reconciling cursed people and things so that they can be brought to worship God. And that combines loving your neighbor with loving God. And then the last two sermons, looking at loving God by separating yourself from the pagan cultural practices of unbelievers, particularly in the matters of information gathering and personal grooming, grieving practices, the treatment of women, holidays, and relating to the spirit world and guidance. Chapter 19 closes by returning to principles of loving your neighbor by being courteous to them. Specifically showing respect to elderly people, showing hospitality to visitors, and showing honesty to business customers. So I want to look at those three points as the main points of my sermon this morning. But when I think of stories that illustrate courtesy, my mind goes back to the children's fantasy stories that George MacDonald wrote. Late in his life, he was has a lot of similarities to me. He had 11 children and tried to plant a church, and it wasn't very successful. And maybe I've been more successful than him than he was. He was congregational, so very similar theology, although he does have some curious twists to his theology that I don't fully agree with. But he has a lot of his kids begged him to write down the stories that he would tell them at night, and it turned into his Princess series. He has written a few books, and I really appreciate and in his children's stories the way he weaves in just principles of courtesy and wisdom, and he kind of just throws in these little nuggets as you're reading to your kids that are very edifying. The Princess and Curdy is one of the books in the series and illustrates a lot this contrast between those who are not courteous and those who are courteous. And I pretty much, you'd have to read the whole book to get the full picture, but maybe just an excerpt from this can give a picture of this contrast a little bit. The Curdy is a miner, one one who worked in the mines digging gold for the king, and he received a call to go help the king with a problem. And so as this excerpt opens, he is entering the capital city in order to go meet the king and find out find out what he needs to do. After a long ascent, he reached the principal gate of the city and entered it. The street was very steep, ascending towards the palace, which rose in great strength above all the houses. And just as they entered, a baker, his shop was a few doors inside the gate, came out in his white apron and ran to the shop of his friend, the barber, on the opposite side of the way. But as he ran, he stumbled and fell heavily. Curdy hastened to help him up and found that he had bruised his forehead badly. The baker swore grievously at the stone for tripping him up, declaring it was the third time this month that he had fallen over it, saying, what was the king about that he allowed such a stone to stick up forever in the main street of his royal residence? Curdie went up to the bump on the street, which had repeated itself on the baker's head, and turning the hammer end of his mattock, struck it such a blow that it flew wide in pieces. But out flew the barber upon him in a rage. What do you break my window for, you rascal, with your pickaxe? I'm very sorry, said Curdie. It must have been a bit of stone that flew from my mattock. I couldn't help it, you know. Couldn't help it, a fine story. What do you go breaking the rock for, the very rock upon which our city stands? Well, look at your friend's forehead, said Curdie. See what a lump he's got on it from falling over that stone. What's that to my window? Cried the barber. His forehead can mend itself. My window can't. But he's the king's baker, said Curdie, more and more surprised at the man's anger. What's that to me? This is a free city. Every man here takes care of himself, and the king takes care of us all. I'll have you pay the price of my window, or the exchequer shall pay for it. Then Curdie picked up one of the rocks. I suppose you're going to break another of my windows with that stone, said the barber. Oh, no, said Curdie. I didn't mean to break your window. I certainly won't break another. Give me that stone, said the barber. Curdie gave it to him, and the barber threw it over the city wall. I thought you wanted the stone, said Curdie. No, you fool, answered the barber. What should I want a stone for? Curdie stooped and picked up another. Give me that stone, said the barber. No, answered Curdie. You just told me you don't want a stone, but I do. The barber took Curdie by the collar. Come now, you pay me for that window. How much? Asked Curdie. The barber said, a crown. But the baker, annoyed at the heartlessness of the barber, and who thought more of his broken window than the bump on his friend's forehead, interfered. No, no, he said to Curdie. Don't you pay any such sum. A little pain like that will cost a quarter. Well, to be certain, said Curdie, I'll give him a half. For he doubted the baker as well as the barber. Perhaps one day, if he finds he's asked too much, he'll bring me the difference. Ha, laughed the barber. Just a little illustration of the discourtesy of the people of this king's city that he ran into. And I would like to show some of the biblical principles of courtesy as they are outlined here in the law in these few verses. And the first one is to show respect to the elderly. Verse 32 says, before the presence of an aged woman you should rise, and you should exalt the presence of an old man. Thus you shall show respect before your God. I am the Lord. Now, the Hebrew word for aged, sheba, seems to have a root meaning of being gray, which is the old-fashioned term hoary, white. It occurs in parallel with zakein, the Hebrew word for elderly, so it's obviously referring to old age here. And furthermore, it's referring to a person, not just to hair, and it is feminine in Hebrew, not masculine. So I translated it aged woman. It may or may not be the best way, but that's the way I went. So the purpose for standing up, though, is to show respect, not only to that person, but ultimately to God, as the last part of this verse states. In many circles, it still shows respect to stand up when a venerable person enters the room. Gentlemen still stand to make sure there's a chair for a lady to sit on. As people get older, too, our bodies break down. We become more and more uncomfortable. And you younger folks should do what you can to help the older folks feel comfortable, overcoming pain and confusion that they're experiencing, even if you younger folks would not need those extra levels of comfort for yourself. Furthermore, the presence of an elder or an elderly person is something that any wise young person should want to take extra trouble to welcome, because it is the calling of godly elders to impart wisdom to the younger folks. Failing to exalt the elderly, that is a failure to show them that kind of honor and respect, could result in them feeling like you don't want them around. And if they don't want to be around you, you're going to be deprived of their wisdom, and you're going to be the loser. The least you can do is listen when they speak and be slow to contradict them. People with two or three four times your life experience, know all kinds of things that you younger folks don't even know about. You do well to take that into account. Caroline Montgomery was an elderly widow in the church that I grew up in. And I remember as a child, when my brother and I would greet her on Sunday morning, she would always have M&Ms in her purse she'd give us. And so we really liked her for that. As I grew older, I realized there are more important reasons to appreciate her. She had a real heart for prayer and for hospitality and for generosity. And I'll never forget one day when I was in junior high school, she walked into our school cafeteria. She was a very old woman by this time. She bought lunch and sat down in the middle of the, you know, hundreds of kids yelling and carrying on. And I heard a boy at the table next to me say, "What's that old bag doing around here?" And he was answered with snickers. But I'll tell you what she was doing there. She was praying for the children that she was seeing around her. She'd come there to pray for us. But my classmates didn't want her around because she was old. I'm glad she didn't leave. Her prayers are important. Now, I recognize that it is possible to go overboard and show too much honor. You can compromise the truth by saying things that are just flattery. You can compromise justice by being prejudicial in your treatment of the elderly. You can compromise piety to God by worshiping ancestors. That's not what we're talking about here. There's a balance. Verse 15 brings out that balance. It uses the same words. Exalt the presence of. Here it says, you shall not exalt the presence of. You shall not inflate the face of the great. So there's a balance. You do want to show honor and respect, but not to the point that they that God's law is violated for some other reason. Don't be so effusive in your praise for older people that they get puffed up with pride, or more likely they'll be disgusted with your insincerity. Do let them know you appreciate them being around. And then when you get to be old, maybe the young folks will treat you with the same respect that they saw you model to your elders. This runs against the grain of our secular culture, though. Secularism despises maturity. It exalts foolishness. It despises old ways of wisdom and prizes revolution and change. It intentionally separates the youth from the elderly in order to brainwash the youth into this culture of humanistic revolution. It's intentional, and it's part of this religious system. As Gordon Wenham wrote in his commentary on Leviticus, a society which fails to honor the old is on the brink of destruction. And I think that's our own nation is close to that now. God's word, on the other hand, creates a beautiful culture that integrates us as humans across our stages of maturity through the self-discipline of humility and respect and care for those who are older than us. So there's one principle of courtesy, respect for the elder. The next one is kindness to the stranger, to the visitor. When a visitor visits you in your land, y'all may not take advantage of him. The visitor visiting with y'all shall be treated by y'all like a native among yourselves, and you shall love him as yourself. Because visitors are what y'all were in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Do you remember the feeling of traveling somewhere, trying to take care of a problem and realizing you were helpless to meet your own needs? Remembering having to rely on someone who offered to help you, but you didn't know whether they were really going to try to take advantage of you or whether they were sincerely trying to help you. You just didn't know. I remember that helpless feeling couple of times this summer in the Uruguayan taxi cabs. I load my daughters into the back and get into the front, entrusting our lives to the hands of the stranger who's going to be careening down this cutthroat traffic in Montevideo. I think one of the first taxi rides we took, we got to our destination. I got out, handed him the smallest bill I had in the local currency, knowing it should be about four times what he should charge. The taxi driver shook his head and pointed to a sign on his dash. The sign was written in Spanish, and I don't read Spanish very well, so I wasn't quite sure what the sign said, but he was obviously not happy with my payment for some reason. The sign apparently said that he couldn't offer change for a bill that size, which was ridiculous because he'd only have to have three customers before he'd have enough change for that. So I don't know why he was refusing to offer change, but I ended up having to pay four times what the taxi ride was worth because I believe he was being dishonest. But I had, as a foreigner, I couldn't even argue with him. I didn't even know how to speak his language. I just had to pay. I'm sure we all have our stories about mechanics that charge us for repairs that we didn't really need, or mean kids that took advantage of the fact that we were new. I don't know how many of you ever went on a snipe hunt before. people have done a lot worse to foreigners. The Hebrew word yana is a relatively specialized term in Hebrew. Occurs only 20 times, and Isaiah 49:26 is one of them. It's in the context of waging war. These people that were going to capture and exile the Jews. Psalm 74:8 is also talking about the capture and exile of the Jews, the burning and sacking of the temple. Jeremiah 22, also context of committing robbery and violence, shedding innocent blood. Three times in Ezekiel 18, it's used to describe robbery, usury, withholding a garment taken in pledge. And in perfect consistency with justice, God brings back these verses from Leviticus 19 in his court case against the nation of Israel in Ezekiel's day, laying out the sentence as their judge in Ezekiel 22. The people of the land have used oppressions, committed robbery, and mistreated the poor and needy. That's just and wrongfully oppressed the stranger. That's right out of Leviticus 19. So I sought for a man among them who could make a wall and stand in the gap before me on behalf of the land, that I should not destroy it, but I found no one. Therefore I have poured out my indignation on them and consumed them with the fire of my wrath and recompensed their deeds on their own heads, says the Lord God. And then later on in Ezekiel we see him promised to bring in a new prince of peace who will never oppress his people. That's fulfilled in the coming of Christ. The Jews failed to uphold this law. You are to be different. You are to show as much consideration to strangers, aliens, sojourners, visitors, as you would to a local or even to yourself. How can you do that practically? In a university town, we have an easy opportunity to show hospitality to foreigners through friendships with international students. Great to see some. It's a blessing to have internationals with us. Simply noticing if a freshman looks lost, giving him helpful directions, makes a huge difference for a newcomer who typically is initially just bewildered by all the things they have to learn and figure out. It seems that international students have a particularly hard time getting transportation. It's hard to get a driver's license here. And it takes, you usually have to be in the States a couple of years before they get their own car. So providing rides to church or to stores can be very practical ways to help. Sharing meals together is another very simple and practical way to show hospitality. I'm told that most international students never see the inside of American home. You can change that statistic for a few of them. If you aren't up to inviting them into your house, you can always, you know, offer to buy them a meal at a restaurant. The simple gestures of hospitality may be the only ones that some ever experience here in America. Now, obviously, there are limits to the risks that you want to expose yourself to with a stranger. Probably not be wise to hand your personal credit card over to the guy at Walmart that's with the cardboard sign. But to the extent that it's appropriate, God calls us to share hospitality. Ways that he encourages us to do that, one is by calling you to remember. Let the remembrance of your own experiences of being a newcomer, let that give you sympathy for others who are newcomers. When you run into someone who ain't from around here, remember what it was like for you to be a stranger in a strange place. Let that memory of your time of helplessness give you sympathy to show hospitality. Now, don't try to do that in your own strength, though. The other very important principle is we must do it by drawing upon the love of God in order to give us that love. We must draw upon the love of God who cares for the alien and the stranger to empower you to love them. Our hospitality is ultimately not just to be nice or to make the world a more peaceful place. It is to introduce outsiders to the blessing of being made right with God through faith in Jesus. That's the ultimate goal of hospitality, is to introduce them to the blessings of being made right with God. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown in their commentary said the Israelites were to hold out encouragement to strangers to settle among them that they might be brought to the knowledge and worship of the true God. There's the ultimate purpose. Matthew Henry, in his amazing prose, strangers shall be welcome to God's grace, and therefore we should do what we can to invite them to it, to recommend religion to their good opinion. So showing hospitality to visitors and showing respect to the elderly are basic principles of Christian courteousness. And the third one that's addressed here is has to do with our business transactions, showing honesty with customers. Verses 35 through 36. Y'all may not do what is unfair in justice with the measurement of size, with the measurement of weight, or with the measurement of volume. Scales that are right, weights that are right, bushel baskets that are right, and a gallon jug that is right are what y'all should own. I am the Lord your God, and it is I who caused y'all to get out of the land of Egypt. Three words for standards of weight and measure are found in verse 35. The first Hebrew word is middah, and about 75% of the times it occurs in the Old Testament, it's describing something measured in cubits. So it could be referring to general metrics of any sort. The NAS tends to go that direction, but I think it's more likely to be referring to measurements of length, height, width. That's King James, NIV, and ESV go that direction, and I prefer that. Particular applications in Bible times include fabric and clothes making. You see that in Psalm 133. Construction work shows up in Ezekiel 40 when the angel is showing Ezekiel how to build the coming temple, and in Nehemiah 3 when the people begin building the wall and each of them gets a certain width of wall that they are to reconstruct. Even shows up in the measurement of gemstones in 1 Kings 7. And it applies to us today. a wide variety of applications, from real estate, any field of engineering. Measurements are very important, aren't they? Even sports refereeing. Get the yardage just right. Make the call right. The next word, mishkal, specifies weight. The unit of measurement for weight in the Old Testament was shekels or talents. Weight measurements were important for people who used gold and silver as currency. So God's command to exercise honest, fair, righteous standards and weight metrics includes not only weighing things properly, like vegetables at the grocery store that are sold by the pound, or weighing trucks at the weigh stations on the interstate, selling staples like flour and sugar that are sold by the pound, prepackaged. Also, it applies to not cheating in payments of money, returning the excess if the cashier gives you too much change, paying laborers what they're worth, paying bills on time, so that money is not used in a way that defrauds other people. The third Hebrew word describing metrics is mashura, which indicates capacity or volume. And in Ezekiel 4, which is one of only two passages where this word is found besides Leviticus, it's the context of measuring amounts of drinking water, and the measuring amount is the hin. The other passage is 1 Chronicles 23:29. It's in the context of baking breads. And I can tell you that measuring ingredients properly when baking is important. I consider myself a pretty good cook, but my style of cooking is usually fairly spontaneous and creative. And I've never been successful in making baked goods. Every time I make pancakes, they don't work. Or bread, they doesn't rise. And I think it's because I'm not careful enough in measuring that exact amount of leavening and salt and different things that it needs, that just the right balance of. Even in our water supply, we have to be accurate in measuring the treatment chemicals that are put in there. The company has to be accurate in charging you for the amount of water you've used in your household. When you go to the gas pump, you want a pump that's going to accurately measure the gallons so you're not paying too much. At the grocery store, you've probably noticed a certain brand is cheaper than the others, and you reach for it and you realize, wait a minute, they've made the box smaller and they're selling less product, but they're selling it for the same price as the others that have the old size, bigger boxes. That's not good. You're actually buying less product and paying the same amount or more. Fairness in all these areas is a very practical matter. The world says that beating the competition and making more money is the goal, but God says the ultimate goal is to conform to His character, which includes being honest, truthful, and fair. Not conforming to God's character destroys the very fabric of society. John Calvin, in his commentary on this verse, said, "Deception in weights and measures destroys and sweeps away all legitimate modes of dealing. If the laws of buying and selling are corrupted, human society is, in a manner, dissolved." The Bible talks about this kind of fairness in terms of tzaddik, righteousness. Proverbs talk about that. Dishonest scales are an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is His delight. Honest weights and scales belong to the Lord. All the weights in the bag are His. He is the ultimate authority over standards of weight and measure. Diverse weights are an abomination to the Lord. Dishonest scales are not good. And Ezekiel, God brings up his beef against people fudging on these standards of weight and measure. He says, "Enough, O princes of Israel, remove violence and plundering, execute justice, righteousness. Stop dispossessing my people," says the Lord God. "You shall have honest scales, an honest ephah, an honest bath. The ephah and the bath shall be of the same measure, so that the bath contains 1/10 of an omer, the ephah 1/10 of an omer, their measure according to the omer. The shekel shall be 20 gerahs," and so forth. There need to be predictable, long-standing consistency to the way that you measure things. And Amos, he also brings up God's criticism against his people for fudging in this area. "Hear this, you who swallow up the needy," and it is the poor and needy that get hurt the most by this kind of dishonesty. The wealthy may be able to afford to lose some money. The wealthy may be able to do something about it, but it's the poor that can't do anything about it and can't afford to lose. "You who make the poor of the land to fail, making the ephah large and the shekel large," so the ephah small and the shekel large, "falsifying scales by deceit, that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals, even sell the bad wheat. The Lord has sworn by the pride of Jacob, surely I will never forget any of their works. Shall not the land tremble for this? And everyone mourn who dwells in it. I will turn your feasts into mourning and all your songs into lamentation. Those who swear by the sin of Samaria, they shall fall and never rise again." And that's exactly what happened to the northern kingdom of Israel, because they did not heed Amos's warning. Micah also warned God's people later on, "Shall I count pure those with the wicked scales, with the bag of deceitful weights? For her rich men are full of violence. Her inhabitants have spoken lies, and their tongue is deceitful in their mouth. Therefore, I will make you sick by striking you and making you desolate because of your sins." God cares about your everyday business transactions. He cares deeply about it. And he will bring us to accountability for how we conduct our business. The words in verse 36 literally describe putting stones on a balance scale to measure weight. You've got a balance beam hanging off a fulcrum, and you put a certain amount of weight on one side and a certain amount of weight on the other, and if the balance beam levels, then you've got the exact same amount on both sides. And so they would, if you're paying a silver coin, they have stones that they know or a certain exact weight, and you put your silver on the other side until both the buyer and the seller are agreed that, okay, that's the exact right amount of silver to pay for these goods that you're buying. That's the way they did it in the old days. We do have different ways of measuring weight now, you know, against a metal spring that moves a needle across a dial, or perhaps a pressure on a piezoelectric material that sends electrons out of that material that are measured by a computer and gives a screen readout. But the basic idea is the same. In Deuteronomy 25, we said, "You shall not have in your bag differing weights, a heavy one and a light one." I have my heavy 1-pound stone that I put on the scale when you're paying me, so that you end up paying me more than a pound, and then I'll put my light 1-pound stone down there when I am selling you something, so that what I sell you is actually less than a pound. You shall have a perfect and just weight, perfect and just measure, right, that your days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. For all who do such things, who behave unrighteously, are an abomination to the Lord your God. So, again, how do we apply this? One way is using high-quality measuring instruments in your business, in your work, and take good care of them. One way that the ancient Jews kept their weights accurate was to use polished stones for weights instead of metal weights, because metal would rust. They had not invented mixing the carbon with the iron to keep it stainless. And so that's why it talks about using stones. They would use stones that were polished. And then you'd know if they've been chipped off. Somebody's cheating. Today we're not so concerned with rust as we are with inflation, right? America's early problems with the devaluation of the continental dollar led to the wise precaution in the U.S. Constitution that said Congress can coin money. And the word coin was intentional. They never intended for Congress, for the U.S. government, to print any more money after the terrible experience they had with the Continentals. And in many states, I know in Tennessee, the Constitution of Tennessee says nothing but gold or silver shall be legal tender. There's a reason for that. And it's based upon Levitical law. The founding fathers thought that they would prevent their descendants from ever devaluing U.S. currency again, but our government flagrantly violates this law. Every time it prints more dollar bills, every time they loan supposed amounts of money that it doesn't have in the first place, what they're doing is increasing the amount of dollar bills out there and therefore decreasing the value of each individual dollar bill. That's inflation, and it is robbery. It's dishonest. Until Americans recognize this, inflation will continue to get worse. And it tends to get worse on an exponential curve. Of course, cheating happens in many other ways. Humans are very creative when it comes to sin. I read about farmers that feed their cows salt water right before going to market, so the cows are drinking all extra water because they get extra thirsty, and then they weigh more. The farmer gets paid more. And then the trucker starves them so that the cows weigh less for his purposes. Dishonesty, any kind of dishonesty, is condemned by God. Hebrew words in verse 36, some of them you may not be familiar with. The ephah is a bushel basket used to measure food. The hin would be a jug, a container, a pitcher. And they would generally be around the size of a gallon, maybe a little more. God says in verse 36, the way to keep your units of measurement just and honest is to chuck the ones that are not right. You, the ones that you should use, are the ones that give a correct measurement. Get rid of the rest. Why? So that you can always be right. And if somebody sues you, they can't win, right? Is that what he says? Is the reason why? No. So you can be a nice person. So everybody will like you and everybody will be nice to each other. Is that the reason why he gives? No. Maybe in VeggieTales, but not the Bible here. The reason is because the Lord is your God, and the Lord has delivered you from slavery. That's why you're honest. He has intervened to bring salvation into your life, and he expects that you'll reciprocate by reaching into his character and bringing out into the world his justice, his fairness, his righteousness. Believers should use accurate standards of weight and measure because it shows what God is like. That's why we do it. When the world fudges on its accounting or on its inventories and you don't, what you're doing is participating in the holiness of God, and you're showing the world what holiness is. So verse 37, it says, so you shall keep all my statutes and my judgments, and you all shall do them. I am the Lord. Loving your neighbor by showing respect to the elderly, showing hospitality to visitors, showing honesty to business customers, brings blessing to the whole fabric of a nation. But never forget that the reason we do these things is because honor, love, and justice flow from the character of God. We do these things because we love God.